The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com, and that is gsuggsinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 28, 2020. The cover is in black and white with one small red entry near the bottom right-hand corner. In red it says, An American Failure. The black and white is read left to right, across the page, up and down. It's superimposed with Time in a gray tone. 20,000 is imposed in bright white, beneath which is an underlay of all kinds of dates and numbers beginning in February 29, 2020, ending September 8. It lists the number of deaths per day. And that cover illustration, I shall not read to you all of the numbers, but it does span from the end of February until September 8. The credit for that illustration is John Mavrudis for Time. The data was supplied by Johns Hopkins University. The first thing I shall read is from the editor. A devastating milestone. Edward Felsenthal is editor-in-chief and CEO. In March, as the global pandemic hit New York, my colleague Kat Moon decided, wisely it turned out, given what was ahead for the U.S., to decamp to her childhood home, Taipei. Despite its proximity to mainland China, where the outbreak originated, Taiwan has seen only 495 cases and 7 deaths among its more than 23 million people, making its response to the coronavirus one of the most successful in the world. So successful, in fact, that last month it was able to host one of the largest public gatherings reported since social distancing began, a 10,000-person live arena concert, which Moon and photographer An Rong Zhu attended and covered for Time. As one U.S. reader put it on Twitter, an arena concert taking place with corona restrictions honestly seems like it's happening on another planet, considering what is going on here in the U.S. While a great many mysteries remain around COVID-19, the most effective ways to curb its spread are not among them. That is the theme of this week's cover story by Alex Fitzpatrick and Elijah Wolfson, echoing what scientists around the world have made clear now for many months. Not testing alone. Not physical distancing alone. Not contact tracing alone. Not masks alone. Do it all. Says World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. Countries that have adopted this comprehensive approach have suppressed transmission and saved lives. And then there is the U.S., which will soon cross a devastating marker, 200,000 deaths caused by COVID-19. That death toll, equivalent to U.S. deaths in more than 3 Vietnams, or the entire population of Salt Lake City, is the world's largest by far, and more deaths per capita than in all but 12 other countries. I spoke this week to Tom Ridge, the former Republican governor of Pennsylvania, who later served as the first secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, a role created after September 11, 2001, out of the recognition that the threat of terrorist attacks on American soil would be forever part of the nation's reality. There are clear parallels not only with the continuing threat of COVID-19, but also with the likelihood of future pandemics that virologists predict may well be worse. We see in a painful and dramatic way the globalization of disease, and it is incumbent on us to make some rather substantive changes, Ridge says. If we don't, then shame on us, and shame on our leadership. For this week's U.S. cover, we turn to artist John Mavroudis, who, using data from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, hand-wrote the death counts in America on every one of the 193 days between February 29, the first confirmation of a COVID-related death in the U.S., and September 8, as it neared time to go to press. Out of that data, the illustration reveals the coming grim milestone of 200,000. Creative director D.W. Pine then placed the illustration within a black border, only the second time in our history we have done so, the first being after 9/11. I really hope this cover is a wake-up call for those who are numbed to this catastrophe, says Mavroudis. Science and common sense are the answers to this crisis. There is some good news. The data suggests we are reducing the death rate in America among people who contract the virus. And as Times' Alice Park notes elsewhere in this issue, it is possible that at least one vaccine may be available by the time 2020 comes to an end, although distribution will create many new questions and challenges. In the meantime, it is not too late to do better. Here's the conversation page, beginning with the words, "What you said about the new American Revolution." After reading the essays and conversations about creating a better future for Black Americans in the August 31, September 7 issue, readers agreed the U.S. has a lot of work to do to live up to its founding promise of equality. Ron Armile of Orlando said it's time to accept America has a caste system. As a way to help, Burton Garrett of Watkinsville, Georgia, endorsed rapper 21 Savage's idea to teach financial literacy in schools. Readers also had ideas for future dialogues. Seal Lucas of Elk Ridge, Maryland, suggested extending conversations to include deaf black people, while Ronald Burke of Albuquerque, New Mexico, called for more conservative black voices, such as Utah congressional candidate Burgess Owens. What does kindness look like? In the same issue, Rebecca Taussig, who uses a wheelchair, sparked a range of reactions with her essay on unhelpful attempts to help disabled people. Kenneth Wayne Thomas in Austin, who's autistic, agreed that certain attempts to be helpful can be insulting, while Daryl G. Andrews, a quadriplegic person in Livingston, Louisiana, said it was petty to reject the kindness of strangers. Potential helpers saw the issue in a new way, too. Jill M. DePlato of Livingston, New Jersey, realized how often being kind is merely about satisfying our own need to feel helpful. Time 100. This year, Time will unveil its annual list of the world's 100 most influential people in an hour-long primetime broadcast, airing September 22. Conversations will continue online through a three-part series of Time 100 talks airing September 23 to 25 on time.com. Editors decide, but you can vote for who you think should be on the 2020 Time 100 at time.com/time-100, that is the numerals, -reader-poll-2020. Kudos. The project in El Salvador, Violence is Driving Girls to Kill Themselves, from Time and Univision, has been nominated for a News and Documentary Emmy in the category of Outstanding New Approaches. Current News. Watch on univision.com and at time.com/gender-violence. For the record, change your lives out there. Jacob Blake, who was shot 7 times by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, speaking to the public from his hospital bed in a September 5 video statement. Healthcare workers in India are already exhausted. Harjit Singh Bhatti, a physician in the COVID-19 ward of Delhi's Manipal Hospital, speaking to The Guardian as India on September 7 passed Brazil as the country with the second highest number of COVID-19 cases. 93% proportion of U.S. racial justice protests from May 24 to August 22 that went forward peacefully, according to a September 3 report from the nonprofit Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. Yes, this does break international law in a very specific and limited way. Brandon Lewis, UK Northern Ireland Secretary, responding to a question in Parliament September 8 about a proposal to make cross-border trade rule changes that would override the Brexit agreement between the EU and the UK. 5, the number of mountain lion dens, home to a total of 13 kittens, found by researchers this summer in the Santa Monica Mountains and Simi Hills near Los Angeles, a record for such a short period, the National Park Service reported, September 2. People say teachers are not working. We're working harder than ever. Jessica Matthews, an English teacher at Carmen Ainsworth High School in Flint, Michigan. The school is set to conduct classes remotely through September. He wasn't a sucker, Joe Biden. Democratic Party presidential nominee speaking September 4 of his late son, Beau, an Army officer who died of cancer in 2015, after The Atlantic reported President Donald Trump had referred to fallen American soldiers as losers and suckers. Good news of the week, a young girl, her father, and a family dog were rescued September 3 after spending more than 2 days trapped in a ravine in Oregon's Mount Hood National Forest. The American nightmare, how the U.S. succumbed to complacency and let 200,000 people die of COVID-19, by Alex Fitzpatrick and Elijah Wolfson. This is the cover story, as indicated on the cover and also in the editorial. 45 days before the announcement of the first suspected case of what would become known as COVID-19, the Global Health Security Index was published. The project, led by the Nuclear Threat Initiative and the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, assessed 195 countries on their perceived ability to handle a major disease outbreak. The U.S. ranked first. It is clear the report was wildly overconfident in the U.S., failing to account for social ills that had been accumulated in the country over the past few years, rendering it unprepared for what was about to hit. At some point in mid-September, perhaps by the time you are reading this, the number of confirmed coronavirus-related deaths in the U.S. will have passed 200,000, more than in any other country by far. If early in the spring the U.S. had mobilized its ample resources and expertise in a coherent national effort to prepare for the virus, things might have turned out differently. If in midsummer the country had doubled down on the measures, masks, social distancing rules, restricted indoor activities and public gatherings, that seemed to be working, instead of prematurely declaring victory, things might have turned out differently. The tragedy is that if science and common sense solutions were united in a national, coordinated response, the U.S. could have avoided many thousands of more deaths this summer. Indeed, many other countries in similar situations were able to face this challenge, where the U.S. apparently could not. Italy, for example, had a similar per capita case rate as the U.S. in April. By emerging slowly from lockdowns, limiting domestic and foreign travel, and allowing its government response to be largely guided by scientists, Italy has kept COVID-19 almost entirely at bay. In that same time period, U.S. daily cases doubled before they started to fall in late summer. Among the world's wealthy nations, only the U.S. has an outbreak that continues to spin out of control. Of the 10 worst-hit countries, the U.S. has the 7th highest number of deaths per 100,000 population. The other 9 countries in the top 10 have an average per capita GDP of $10,195, compared to $65,281 for the U.S. Some countries, like New Zealand, have even come close to eradicating COVID-19 entirely. Vietnam, where officials implemented particularly intense lockdown measures, did not record a single virus-related death until July 31. There's nothing auspicious about watching the summer turn to autumn. All the new season brings are more hard choices at every level, from elected officials responsible for the lives of millions to parents responsible for the lives of one or two children. Americans will continue to have to make nearly impossible decisions, despite the fact that after months of watching their country fail, many are now profoundly distrustful, uneasy, and confused. At this point, we can start to see why the U.S. foundered: a failure of leadership at many levels and across parties, a distrust of scientists, the media, and expertise in general, and deeply ingrained cultural attitudes about individuality and how we value human lives have all combined to result in a horrifically inadequate pandemic response. COVID-19 has weakened the U.S. and exposed the systemic fractures in the country and the gulf between what this nation promises its citizens and what it actually delivers. Although America's problems were widespread, they start at the top. A complete catalog of President Donald Trump's failures to address the pandemic will be fodder for history books. There were weeks wasted early on stubbornly clinging to a fantastical belief that the virus would simply disappear. Testing and contact tracing programs were inadequate. States were encouraged to reopen ahead of his own administration's guidelines, and statistics were repeatedly cherry-picked to make the U.S. situation look far better than it was, while undermining scientists who said otherwise. "I wanted to always play it down," Trump told the journalist Bob Woodward March 19 in a newly revealed conversation. "I still like playing it down because I don't want to create panic." Common sense solutions like face masks were undercut or ignored. Research shows that wearing a facial covering significantly reduces the spread of COVID-19, and a pre-existing culture of mask wearing in East Asia is often cited as one reason countries in that region were able to control their outbreaks. In the U.S., Trump did not wear a mask in public until July 11, more than 3 months after the CDC recommended facial coverings, transforming what ought to have been a scientific issue into a partisan one. A Pew Research Center survey published June 25 found that 63% of Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents said masks should always be worn in public, compared with 29% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. By far, the government's most glaring failure was a lack of adequate testing infrastructure from the beginning. Testing is key to a pandemic response. The more data officials have about an outbreak, the better equipped they are to respond. Rather than call for more testing, Trump has instead suggested maybe the U.S. should be testing less. He has repeatedly and incorrectly blamed increases in new cases on more testing. If we didn't do testing, we'd have no cases, the president said in June, later suggesting he was being sarcastic. But less testing only means fewer cases are detected, not that they don't exist. In the U.S., the percentage of tests coming back positive increased from about 4.5% in mid-June to about 5.7% as of early September. Evidence the virus was spreading regardless of whether we tested for it. By comparison, Germany's overall daily positivity rate is under 3%, and in Italy it is about 2%. Testing in the U.S. peaked in July at about 820,000 new tests administered per day, according to the COVID Tracking Project, but as of this writing has fallen to about 740,000. Some Americans now say they're waiting more than 2 weeks for test results, a delay that makes the outcome all but worthless, as people can be infected in the window between when they get tested and when they receive their results. Most experts believe that early on we did not understand the full scale of the spread of the virus because we were testing only those who got sick. But now we know 30% to 45% of infected people who contract the virus show no symptoms whatsoever and can pass it on. When there is a robust and accessible testing system, even asymptomatic cases can be discovered and isolated. But as soon as testing becomes inaccessible again, we're back to where we were before, probably missing many cases. 7 months after the coronavirus was found on American soil, we are still suffering hundreds, sometimes more than 8,000 deaths every day. An American Nurses Association survey from late July and early August found that of 21,000 U.S. nurses polled, 42% reported either widespread or intermittent shortages in personal protective equipment, PPE, like masks, gloves, and medical gowns. Schools and colleges are attempting to open for in-person learning, only to suffer major outbreaks and send students home. Some of them will likely spread the virus in their communities. More than 13 million Americans remain unemployed as of August, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics data published September 4. U.S. leaders have largely eschewed short and medium-term, unflashy solutions in favor of perceived silver bullets like a vaccine. Hence the administration's Operation Warp Speed, an effort to accelerate vaccine development. The logic of focusing so heavily on magic wand solutions fails to account for the many people who will suffer and die in the meantime, even while effective strategies to fight COVID-19 already exist. I'm stopping here to describe a couple of photographs on this page. People are sleeping in a parking lot in Las Vegas after a homeless shelter shut down because of COVID-19. This is a parking lot in front of something called Cashman Center. And in every parking space in at least three rows, so that would be a few dozen individuals, actually it's more like seven rows, probably a dozen to 20 individuals in each row. These people are just huddled on the ground, on asphalt. Some appear to be covered with blankets or sheets, and others are not. There are lots of bright lights in the background because of this Cashman Center facility. There's a line for a drive-through pantry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's in the second picture. This also depicts a daytime parking lot as opposed to the nighttime parking lot in the Las Vegas photo. In the daytime parking lot, it appears to be a shopping center. There are several buildings connected, and the parking lot is quite large, and the line of cars in this food line, I won't attempt to count, but it's in a serpentine pattern. They just wave through. It's like a wave of cars in this parking lot. Both of those photos are from an aerial viewpoint. And the last photo appears to be at night because the sky surrounding this stadium is black, but the stadium itself is lighted with a green on the field and lots of different colors in the stands. There are cardboard cutout fans at an LA Angels baseball game. The camera is facing this from the back, so we don't see any of the photographs of people on the front of these fan cardboard cutouts, but one little section of this quite gigantic stadium is populated by cardboard fans. On the preceding page, there is a photograph of a woman hugging another individual. I can't determine whether or not it's male or female or its age. The woman and the other individual are both wearing masks, and the caption reads, "Friends and family mourn the death of Conrad Coleman Jr., July 3, in New Rochelle, New York. Coleman, 39, died of COVID-19, June 20, just over 2 months after his father also died of the disease." Returning now to the text of the article. "We are also struggling because of the U.S. healthcare system. The country spends nearly 17% of annual GDP on healthcare, far more than any other nation in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Yet it has one of the lowest life expectancies at 78.6 years, comparable to those in countries like Estonia and Turkey, which spend only 6.4% and 4.2% of their GDP on healthcare, respectively. Even the government's decision to cover coronavirus-related treatment costs has ended up in confusion and fear among lower-income patients, thanks to our dysfunctional medical billing system. The coronavirus has laid bare the inequalities of American public health. Black Americans are nearly three times as likely as white Americans to get COVID-19, nearly five times as likely to be hospitalized, and twice as likely to die. As the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, notes, being black in the U.S. is a marker of risk for underlying conditions that make COVID-19 more dangerous, including socioeconomic status, access to health care, and increased exposure to the virus due to occupation, that is, frontline, essential, and critical infrastructure workers. In other words, COVID-19 is more dangerous for black Americans because of generations of systemic racism and discrimination. The same is true, to a lesser extent, for Native American and Latino communities, according to CDC data. COVID-19, like any virus, is mindless. It does not discriminate based on the color of a person's skin or the figure in their checking account. But precisely because it attacks blindly, the virus has given further evidence for the truth that was made clear this summer in response to another of the country's epidemics, racially motivated police violence. The U.S. has not adequately addressed its legacy of racism. Americans today tend to value the individual over the collective. A 2011 Pew survey found 58% of Americans said freedom to pursue life's goals without interference from the state is more important than the state guaranteeing nobody is in need. It is easy to view that trait as a root cause of the country's struggles with COVID-19. A pandemic requires people to make temporary sacrifices for the benefit of the group, whether it is wearing a mask or skipping a visit to the local bar. Americans have banded together in times of crisis before, but we need to be led there. We take our cues from leaders, says Dr. David Rossner, a professor at Columbia University. Trump and other leaders on the right, including Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and Governor Tate Reeves of Mississippi, respectively, have disparaged public health officials, criticizing their calls for shutting down businesses and other drastic but necessary measures. Many public health experts, meanwhile, are concerned the White House is pressuring agencies like the Food and Drug Administration to approve treatments such as convalescent plasma, despite a lack of supportive data. Governors, left largely on their own, have been a mixed bag, and even those who have been praised, like New York's Andrew Cuomo, could likely have taken more aggressive action to protect public health. Absent adequate leadership, it has been up to everyday Americans to band together in the fight against COVID-19. To some extent, that has been happening. Doctors, nurses, bus drivers, other essential workers have been rightly celebrated as heroes, and many have paid a price for their bravery. But at least some Americans still refuse to take such a simple step as wearing a mask. Why? Because we are also in the midst of an epistemic crisis. Republicans and Democrats today don't just disagree on issues, they disagree on the basic truths that structure their respective realities. Half the country gets its news from places that parrot whatever the administration says, true or not. Half does not. This politicization, manifests in myriad ways. But the most vital is this: in early June, at which point more than 100,000 Americans had already died of COVID-19, fewer than half of Republican voters polled said the outbreak was a major threat to the health of the U.S. population as a whole. Throughout July and August, the White House's coronavirus task force was sending private messages to states about the severity of the outbreak, while President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence publicly stated that everything was under control. Some incredulity about the virus and public health recommendations is understandable, given the reality that scientific understanding of the newly emergent virus is evolving in real time. The ever-shifting advice from health officials does not instill public confidence, especially in those already primed to be skeptical of experts. Because this is a new infectious disease, a new virus, we do not have all the answers scientifically, says Colleen Berry, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. I think that creates an environment that could potentially erode trust even further over time. But the trust fractures on partisan lines. While 43% of Democrats told Pew in 2019 they had a great deal of trust in scientists, only 27% of Republicans said the same. Truly worrying are the numbers of Americans who already say they're hesitant to receive an eventual COVID-19 vaccination. Mass vaccination will work only with enough buy-in from the public. The damage the president and others are doing to Americans' trust in science could have significant consequences for the country's ability to get past this pandemic. There is another disturbing undercurrent to Americans' attitude toward the pandemic thus far, a seeming willingness to accept mass death. As a nation, we may have become dull to horrors that come our way as news, from gun violence to the seemingly never-ending incidents of police brutality to the water crises in Flint, Michigan, and elsewhere. Americans seem to have already been inured to the idea that other Americans will die regularly when they do not need to. It is difficult to quantify apathy, but what else could explain that nearly half a year in, we still have not figured out how to equip the frontline workers who, in trying to save the lives of others, are putting their own lives at risk? What else could explain why 66% of Americans, roughly 217.5 million people, still are not always wearing masks in public? Despite all that, it seems the U.S. is finally beginning to make some progress again. Daily cases have fallen from a high of 20.5 per capita in July to around 12 in early September. But we're still well above the springtime numbers. The curve may be flattening, but it's leveling out at a point that is pretty frightening. Furthermore, experts worry that yet another wave could come this winter, exacerbated by the annual flu season. There are reasons for optimism. Efforts to create a vaccine continue at breakneck speed. It is possible at least one will be available by the end of the year. Doctors are getting better at treating severe cases, in part because of new research on treatments like steroids, although some patients are suffering far longer than expected, a phenomenon known as long-haul COVID. As the virus rages, perhaps more Americans will follow public health measures, but there's plenty of room for improvement. At the very least, every American should have access to adequate PPE, especially those in health care, education, food service, and other high-risk fields. We need a major investment in testing and tracing, as other countries have done. Our leaders need to listen to experts and let policy be driven by science. And for the time being, all of us need to accept that there are certain things we cannot or should not do, like go to the movies or host an indoor wedding. Americans may start to say, if everyone's not wearing masks, if everyone's not social distancing, if people are having family parties inside with lots of people together, if we are flouting public health recommendations, we are going to keep seeing transmission, says Ann Keller, an associate professor at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. The U.S. is no longer the epicenter of the global pandemic. That unfortunate torch has been passed to countries like India, Argentina, and Brazil. And in the coming months, there might yet be a vaccine, or more likely, a cadre of vaccines that finally halts the march of COVID-19 through the country. But even so, some 200,000 Americans have already died, and many more may do so before a vaccine emerges, unless America starts to implement and invest in the science-based solutions already available to us. Each one of those lives lost represents an entire world, not only of those individuals, but also of their family, friends, colleagues, and loved ones. This is humbling, and it should be. The only path forward is one of humility, of recognition that if America is exceptional with regard to COVID-19, it is in a way most people would not celebrate. This page is entitled Milestones. A record for California's fire season, 2.2 million acres burned and counting. For the past few years, fall in California has given residents a glimpse of the apocalypse. Fires burn around us. The air smells like a campfire. And the sharp edges of landmarks like Alcatraz and the Golden Gate Bridge blur in the hazy air. We close our windows to avoid breathing smoke, stop going outside, and wear N95 masks, even without a pandemic. But if the past few years have been alarming, 2020 has felt impossible. More than 2.2 million acres have burned so far this season, a record announced by CAL FIRE on September 8. And fire season often lasts into November. Before the pandemic, San Francisco was one of the most prosperous cities in the world, but this year's fire season has made one thing clear. No amount of prosperity can save us from climate change that's sending temperatures soaring and fueling fires. Hardware stores across the region are sold out of AC units, and the smoke has spread so far that driving to cleaner air is no solution. People without means, like San Francisco's homeless, cannot heed warnings to limit outdoor activities. The air quality in more affordable inland areas was so hazardous September 8, one meteorologist labeled it the worst he'd ever seen in the U.S. I love California. From the first year I lived in the state in 2006, I could not believe there was a place of such natural beauty where people grew lemons in their backyards and I could jump in the ocean in December. But this year, the worst in a string of catastrophic years, the smoke is projected to hover for months, and it's hard to imagine an optimistic future for a state that once looked like paradise. That was written by Alana Samuels, Dateline San Francisco. There's an accompanying photograph here, a pond in the foreground. The pond is dark because it's surrounded by dense forest, tall, green trees, spruce and other types of fir. And in the background, it looks like a rainbow, only it's not. It's a fire blazing across California. The Creek Fire near Huntington Lake, California, photograph September 5. The colors in the background sky are those of a rainbow. Lots of yellow, lots of orange, pink, violet. What I don't see, a blue, white, gray, many shades of gray from pale to charcoal. What I don't see is green, except in the trees that border the lake. Died, Lou Brock, base-stealing star. This column by Tim Raines. I was always a sports fan, and when it came to baseball, guys like Lou Brock, who for years held the league record for career stolen bases, were my favorite players. Not because my game was like theirs, but being the player I was more similar to them. And Lou, who died September 6 at 81, was one of those players people could not stop. When I first got called up to the big leagues in 1979, I was in Montreal with the Expos, and Lou, who would retire at the end of that season, was on a trip with the St. Louis Cardinals. We ended up taking a picture together. Lou was a guy who no one really knew at first, and he became one of the best players in the game. But what made Lou special was how great a guy he was. He was someone anyone could approach. He seemed like he always had a smile on his face, and he just enjoyed playing the game. This was as told to Annapurna Kamhampati. And there's a photo here of a smiling Lou Brock. It looks like his number was 20 or 20-something. And he's holding 1, 2, 3 bats that he's apparently weighing for the right feel. And he is smiling, as I mentioned. Brock was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1985. Raines, who wrote the article, Tim Raines, was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2017. I believe Brock played for the St. Louis Cardinals. That was mentioned in the article, but not specified. But his shirt, which I think has the number 20 or 2-something on it, his arm is blocking the view, does have a cardinal on the front of it also, so that might be the big clue. Some more milestones here, very short items, 6 of them on the left-hand column. Dropped charges against Curtis Flowers, 50, a black man accused of a 1996 quadruple homicide in Mississippi, September 4. After 6 trials and 23 years behind bars, halted press credential renewals for foreign journalists with U.S. media outlets by the Chinese government. The foreign ministry said the action was a response to the Trump administration's visa restrictions on Chinese media workers in the U.S. Killed Michael Reinol, 48, a suspect in the August 29 death of a far-right activist in Portland, Oregon, by police September 3. Officials allege he threatened them as they attempted to arrest him. Sunk 5 boats in a boat parade in support of President Trump on Lake Travis near Austin, September 5. The local sheriff blamed the combined wakes of hundreds of vessels circling the lake. Ordered an end to racial sensitivity training by federal agencies on topics such as critical race theory and white privilege by the Trump administration September 4. Won, that's W-O-N, the 2020 Kentucky Derby, which was run September 5 after being postponed from May, by Authentic and jockey John Velazquez, beating out favorite Tiz the Law. From the Time Off Books page, the list of 3 books here. Can't Miss September Fiction, Transcendent Kingdom. While her debut, Homegoing, was a sweeping saga, Yaa Gyasi's follow-up is more narrow in scope, exploring science, faith, and grief through the eyes of a Ghanaian-American neuroscientist. Homeland Elegies. What does it mean to belong? The question is central to playwright Ayad Akhtar's second novel, which follows a man of Pakistani heritage in Trump's America. In finding the answer, Akhtar crafts a stunning narrative about a fractured country. Jack. Marilyn Robinson revisits the world of Gilead, Iowa, in the 4th installment of her acclaimed series. The novel explores the complications of American life through the story of an ill-fated interracial romance. Annabelle Gutterman wrote Time Off Books List. Again, Transcendent Kingdom, Homeland Elegies, and Jack. On the opposite side of the page in the lower corner is a photograph of a woman dressed in a black pantsuit with a white turtleneck. Her face is beautiful. Her hands show her age, though. They have a bit of a coarse look to them with the veins. Her face, again, is beautiful. She has blue eyes, a bright, peachy-colored smile. She's wearing gold discs as earrings. She has a short, spiky, gray-white hairdo. It is Jane Fonda. This column is entitled Quick Talk. The activist and actor, 82, has written a new book about her experiences leading Fire Drill Fridays, where she was arrested weekly in the fall of 2019 while calling for government action on climate change. The book, What Can I Do?, is presented as a guide for those who are concerned about the issue but unsure how to help. Do you think your book will get old? This is in a question and answer format. Do you think your book will get older voters to think about climate change and vote with the issue in mind? Answer, they are already thinking about it. The young climate strikers globally have had a lot to do with that. I am targeting the people who notice the climate crisis and do not know what to do about it. I am teaching them more about it and then giving people things to do. Civil disobedience has to become the new norm, no matter who is elected in November. You write that older women play a critical role in the movement. What do you mean by that? First and foremost, older women generally tend to get braver, less afraid of being upfront in expressing their anger. Studies show women care more about the climate crisis. They are willing to do something about it. But women sometimes feel insecure about the science. I wanted to give the science so they could be more secure in that. Question. You note that you wanted the blessing of fellow climate activists before getting involved. Why was that? Answer. Imagine a movie star comes popping into D.C. and starts holding these rallies every Friday without ever talking to the people who've been there for a year. We met with all the major environmental groups and the young activists asking for their participation and their blessing, and we got along great. Question, what was it like working together? Did you see parts of your younger activist self in them? Answer, oh my God, they're so much better than I was. I'm blown away. They are really smart. They're also very depressed. These young people are carrying grief. Question, how has your approach to activism evolved over the years? Answer, often in my younger years, because I went pretty quickly from being Barbarella to being an activist, I was kind of lost and confused, so I was using other people's narratives. Now it is my narrative that I've metabolized. It is part of me and my body. Question, how are the stakes different this time? Answer, it's all-consuming. This climate crisis is an existential issue that has to be dealt with if anything else is going to be achieved. There were issues that mattered to me before, but they were not life or death. Nothing else is going to matter if this is not solved, like the climate crisis is. That was written by Justin Warland. Jane Fonda's book about Fire Drill Fridays is called What Can I Do? And another column about questions and answers. This is called 10 Questions by Eben Shapiro. Reed Hastings, the Netflix co-CEO on Company Secrets, his new book, No Rules, Rules, and Chilling. This will probably be abridged for time constraints. Question, do you remember that there was a time in this country when people received little plastic discs in the mail in envelopes? Answer, that's crazy. We still have 2 million DVD members because on DVD you get a comprehensive selection. We have all the HBO stuff, every movie ever made. And then, of course, it works in deep rural areas where we do not yet have broadband. Question, you built a company that transformed the global media landscape, yet you wrote a book on corporate culture, not the future of entertainment and technology. Why? Answer, we do not want to give away our secrets in entertainment. Question, how much are you spending on content annually? Answer, $15 billion. Question, are you as impressed as the rest of the world by TikTok? Answer, in the earnings letter, I talked about it a lot, as there's lots of innovation left in the world. And TikTok's growth against YouTube and Facebook is quite remarkable. Question, as they say in business school, what is your target addressable market? Answer, humans on the internet who enjoy entertainment. Question, modest goals. Netflix and chill has become part of the popular lexicon. How do you feel about your corporate name being part of a euphemism for sexual activity? Answer, it is not a campaign we created. We love it that we're important enough to people's lives that they use us in various references, but we neither built that nor do we exploit it. I would say it is recognition of how significant we have become for many people. What grade would you give your search and discovery features, which help subscribers find new movies and shows they might enjoy? Answer, well, internally, I say we suck compared to how good we want to be in 3 years. It's hard. It turns out that human taste is hugely variable. How many people do you have working on improving your discovery function? It depends on the boundaries. This is the answer. I'd say roughly 1,000 people. Question, are those humanists or data scientists? Answer, you need a mix. You have a bunch of humanists sort of generating hypotheses, but they do not know exactly what is possible. And then you have a bunch of data scientists who are really good at what is possible. Question. When you were still building the company in the 2000s, I interviewed you, and you were pretty combative, maybe even a brilliant jerk. Answer, if I came across that way, then it's just personal failings. It is not intention. And again, that was from Reed Hastings, Netflix co-CEO, with his new book, No Rules, Rules. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I'm Patricia. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 875-8889. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service.